Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us. On today's program, Emily McCord has Politics Ohio. Producer Mark Uricki takes us on a road trip to Cleveland, and we'll hear about the 8th annual harvest auction from the Tecumseh Land Trust's Krista McGaugh. Up first, elephants travel in herds, geese in a gaggle. But what do you call a group of human men? Enter the man cave with WISO Community Voices producer Kristen Wicker for a glimpse at male bonding in the modern age.
Men, once rulers of the universe, nowadays have become equals to women and, in some cases, relegated to a back seat. One reaction to this social reality? The man cave, increasingly common throughout the United States. Heck, there are TV shows, websites, and books dedicated to these spaces designed by and for men. But why, in this era of, hey girl, has a space for male bonding become so important? University of Dayton sociology lecturer Jean Holcomb offers one explanation.
We've seen a shift in terms of, like, some spaces that used to be traditionally masculine spaces aren't anymore. So, like, the workplace is not necessarily as male-dominated as it used to be. So to some extent, we might be seeing a shift out of the workplace into other areas.
In an informal survey distributed via my Facebook page, 40 of 41 respondents indicated they know anywhere from 1 to a whopping 50 people with a man cave. Respondents described those spaces as everything from gross, unkempt, and stinky to rad, amazing, and the total package, a place that keeps men out of strip clubs, where they can fart with impunity and examine their private manly thoughts. In general, survey respondents noted these spaces give men a place where boys can be boys, where men can relax and unwind without worrying about the carpet matching the window treatments matching the scented candles. Jeremy Forbes, a sociology professor at UD, said he has a woodworking shop in his garage that functions as a sort of man cave, where his male friends can hang out, drink beer, and look at tools.
What we're seeing now is kind of an overall decline in, like, traditional civic engagement, where in the past men could join the Elks, the Rotary Club, neighborhood groups, things of that nature. What we're seeing is a shift in society. We're becoming a more mobile society. Those roots aren't nearly as deep as they used to be. So this may be a reaction to less involvement in other community groups. So they try to recreate some identity and man space within the home.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe women just want to get their men out of their space for a minute.
You asked me why. Just went on tola.
Indeed, women are generously allowing men to set up shop in garages, basements, and attics across America. My Facebook survey reveals the majority of man caves are in the home, but not all of them. Some guys are really lucky. Dayton resident George Baylog and three of his close friends have a man cave dubbed the Clubhouse in what he calls an undisclosed location near downtown Dayton on the third floor of an old warehouse.
We almost got kicked out the very first night that we had this space set up. And we were so exhilarated at having this space, just full of the potential of this place, that we just went a little nuts and it got really loud. It went way into the morning. We were playing Pink Floyd really loud. And somebody taped us, took it to the landlord. We've toned it down since, and thank God they didn't kick us out.
Since that nearly tragic incident years ago, the Clubhouse has evolved into the ultimate testosterone-fueled party pad.
There are concert posters, political stuff, bourbon bottles. It's almost like a scrapbook of our lives for the past couple of years. And whenever we go out different places, we'll bring back things on our trips to Ireland, our trips to New York, our trips to L.A., and stuff will come back from those things and go up on the wall. So it's kind of like a walk down memory lane in here. One of the nice things about being here, away from where I live, you never know who's going to knock on that door. You never know what's going to happen. There's sort of an element of randomness and chaos over here. So it's kind of like a Las Vegas thing, like what goes on here stays here.
Like so many of the spaces described by my survey respondents, the Clubhouse serves an important role for Baylog and the other men who call it their cave.
You know, you hear the word bonding, you know, it's kind of cliche almost, but you get to see each other in circumstances here and talk about things here that you don't talk about other places. You think back when you had best friends, and most of that usually comes around high school, sometimes in college. If you're lucky enough, you have that for the rest of your life. And I think this is an important part of keeping the quality of the friendship. You can be yourself. We travel together. We do a lot of things outside of here, but a lot of it is cemented and talked about and strengthened, you know, here.
Even still, the clubhouse is not exclusively a boys' club. The clubhouse crew hosts final listening parties, champagne and bourbon tastings, and soirees that invariably include impromptu karaoke sessions with groups of people gathered around a vintage mic stand. Coming to those parties, you can hear music and laughter pouring from the windows while standing in the parking lot three stories below. In those moments, the clubhouse serves a purpose for men and women alike. So while the man cave may be a staple when it comes to male bonding in the modern age, perhaps it also is a reminder that, in the end, men and women have many of the same needs for friendship and fun. For WISO Community Voices, this is Kristen Wicker.
For more information about WISO's Community Voices project, visit WISO.org and join us tonight at 6 and 11 for the Sunday Documentary Hour. You'll hear all the entries from our 2012 Community Voices producers. This is WISO Weekend on WYSO. Thanks again for joining us. On this week's road trip, we're going to Cleveland. Natural resources like a Great Lake and a river may have established the city, but as producer Mark Uricki found out, it was various modes of transportation, from canoes to spaceships, that helped shape the state's largest industrial city.
You can still see the industrial history of Cleveland. Start at the mouth of the Cuyahoga River, where Moses Cleveland stepped ashore from Lake Erie in 1796. That natural resource had already been long used for transportation inland by Native Americans. But George Washington had an idea on how the country could expand west, build a canal that could link to the Erie Canal. With that, farm produce deep inside Ohio could be shipped to markets back east. Tim Donovan, director of the Ohio Canal Corridor, said the young state of Ohio didn't have enough money to build a canal, so they found the money elsewhere.
There was a risk to be taken there, but New York City saw the advantage of that risk, again, in New York State, and they went and they made the deal. And the governor of New York at that time was the canal commissioner before he was governor. So he understood it from day one. You know, this is going to be good for what we do here in New York.
And it worked immediately, fueling growth of towns such as Akron and Massillon.
I mean, once they opened that canal up from Akron, farm goods started shipping through. The port of Cleveland became a real port on the Great Lakes, and we were feeding the eastern markets, and they were in turn feeding us with products from that early days of the Industrial Revolution. So it worked really well in terms of creating mutually beneficial economies in both areas.
Eventually, mines in Stark and Tuscarawas counties began sending canal boats loaded with coal up north. Combine that with iron ore shipped on the Great Lakes from Minnesota, and you get the beginnings of the steel industry. One man working as a broker in the warehouses off the canal was John D. Rockefeller. Historian Ed Pershey of the Western Reserve Historical Society says just as the railroads arrived, Rockefeller realized that oil had been discovered across the border in Pennsylvania.
That's when he starts his oil business. He sees the opportunity, goes to Western Pennsylvania, buys the rights to invents tank cars, puts the crude oil pumping out of the well in tank cars on railroads, brings it to Cleveland for refining on the banks of the Cuyahoga River.
At first, oil was used for lubricants and for kerosene, but Tim Donovan points out it also helped make the city a center for paints and varnishes.
Sherwin-Williams, their first plant was actually a property owned by Rockefeller, used by Standard Oil.
Put oil, steel, and paint together, and Cleveland had all the makings to build the next mode of transportation, automobiles. White Motors began here, Winston, Peerless, and Chandler. At one time, Cleveland was making more cars than Detroit.
Akron's making rubber tires for the cars that are being built in Cleveland. That was a great combination. And we were refining the oil on the banks of our river. And remember that John D. Rockefeller, of course, he sold out his interest in Standard Oil in 1905. And he was the richest man in the United States, maybe in the world. They weren't even making gasoline yet. And he still became, just imagine if, think about the oil industry. That's what it really takes off when cars begin to suck up gasoline. it's astounding.
By World War I, airplanes were being built here. And later, the NASA Lewis Research Center, along with aerospace companies in Akron and Cleveland, made flight suits and rocket parts.
If it wasn't for NASA, at the time, NASA Lewis in the late 50s, early 60s, we wouldn't have put a man on the moon. The development of upper stage propellants and rocket designs were, Cleveland was deeply involved in that.
Today, Cleveland is embracing its industrial history. Along the Cuyahoga River and the Ohio Canal, there are visitor centers and interpretive way stations that tell the story. There are even displays of actual steel slabs and bottle cars and machinery in the shadow of factories and mills that are still working. I'm Mark Uricki in Cleveland.
You can download the new Ohio Guide tours at seeohiofirst.org. The new Ohio Guide is produced by the Ohio Humanities Council, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. On Friday, September 21st, the Tecumseh Land Trust will hold their 8th annual harvest auction. This week, Krista McGall stopped into the studios for a fun conversation with Nikki Dakota about the auction and the important work the Land Trust is doing.
It is always so nice to be with you, Nikki. What fun. And in your new headquarters.
Oh, it is so nice.
Wide open spaces, just like I like, you know?
Plenty of elbow room in here.
This is excellent.
It is so nice. This is because of the years and years of people in the community in the Miami Valley believing in what we're doing. Yep. The university making a big investment in our future and our belief in the ability for us to be a good steward of these airwaves, which sort of makes us, you and me, in the same kind of business.
Honest to Pete, taking care of our local resources, you know, building on them and celebrating them. This auction coming up is definitely a nice celebration. What we do is pretty basic. I think a lot of your listeners know, but we help landowners that want to protect their farm or natural lands, just basically keeping them available for agriculture, for good forestry practices, for just natural habitat. Mm-hmm. And water protection is a pretty big theme of ours, too. So we've protected about 28 stream miles now in around 23,000 acres of land.
The silent auction gets underway a week from Friday. That'll be Friday, September 21st.
Right.
And that's at the Hollenbeck Bailey Creative Arts Center. And that's basically just in the heart of Springfield
right
there.
Right, downtown, next to the Kuss Auditorium. I think some people haven't actually been there yet, but
beautiful facility.
Right in the middle of what's going on in downtown Springfield. Things are really coming together. That hospital's up and running down there now. And we like to have this event right there downtown because we're known for protecting the countryside, but reviving that downtown landscape, that urban environment is such an important complement to what we do. And so every year we have it downtown and we see what's going on, what the progress is like, and it really beautiful park spaces down there now too.
It's true.
Uh-huh. People from the city, the country, Yellow Springs, Dayton, it's just a nice chance for people to get together about, you know, a common issue. Every penny they put on every auction item is going to go towards our saving land. It's what keeps us available to do this work.
Of course, these items are donated from a wide, vast cross-section of people in the community.
Huge. And we have so many people who are so knowledgeable, who share their knowledge, their collections. Once again, we're going to have Dave Newhart sharing his Civil War collection and giving a tour of Whitehall Farm. That's one of the bigger farms that we have protected.
That's
and it was
right.
A big community effort back in 1999.
I remember that just after I got here, I still remember thinking about that. I just arrived after that occurrence. I remember thinking, wow, this community is kind of special.
Honestly, me too. I had just moved here and I wasn't yet working for the Land Trust. And I was taken by storm. I had friends from all over the country calling me up because it was getting national headlines about the amazing effort that came together. And it
keep
succeeded.
This land not from being busted up and turned into divisions. And there was was a sort of a spirit of let's keep the wild flavor, the natural flavor to this place where we live. And you're carrying that on. Tell us, first of all, if people would like to find out a little bit more about this, you can go to TecumsehLandTrust.org. That's the main page there. And there's a link to information about getting tickets and to some of the items that are donated. Again, that's TecumsehLandTrust.org. .org, not com, .org. It's like YSO, non-profit effort here.
Right.
And tell us a little bit, though, about the founding of the Tecumseh Land Trust and the mission of this great collaborative.
Well, basically, Land Trust began to really become known in the, say, 20, 30 years ago nationwide. There were different pots of government money here and there to protect open space, but really not since the national parks has there been a really coherent sort of nationwide effort that's come together to protect land and to continually protect land. Reagan deregulated a lot of the monies that had been out there to purchase open space. And so people actually around Yellow Springs, Miami Township here in Greene County, came together seeing that government wasn't exactly doing this job. There may be a role
through the cracks here.
Yeah, private citizens to take the ball on this. And around that time, the Land Trust Alliance was forming nationwide, and it's kind of our trade organization that offers training. They have a series of standards and practices that ultimately form the backbone of an accreditation program. And I'm proud to say we were the first land trust in Ohio to become accredited. Yeehaw! And it was a lot of work, actually, to make sure we had our records really spit spot. Thanks, however, to our wonderful board, including two attorneys who have donated just thousands of hours of time. We had good meeting minutes. We had good evidence that we make decisions ethically. It is a marvelous board. We've got 18 members right now. We tried to
big board.
It's a big board and a working board. Our committees do a lot of work. We want to have a good geographic representation as well as professional variety and definitely that town and country kind of mix. We've got people who are gardeners. We've got people who are farmers farming thousands of acres in some cases. We just love that mix of people. And I'm kind of always tickled by the idea that this is a theme that unites people. They are not making any more land. Our most recent bumper sticker says asphalt is the last crop. You know, it's mighty hard to break up that asphalt.
Wow.
So we work voluntarily with landowners, and the number of landowners who really, really want help to protect their land for a big variety of reasons, you know, is just astounding. So a lot of what we do is try to help find monies to help those landowners make this possible.
We're talking with Kristen McGaw, who is the executive director of the Tecumseh Land Trust, their annual silent auction, and it's a big deal. Really, it's one of the finest silent auctions I've ever attended. It gets underway a week from Friday. That'll be September 21st at the Hollenbeck Bailey Creative Arts Center, right next to the Kuss Auditorium in the heart of downtown Springfield. You can find out more information and get some tickets there at TecumsehLandTrust.org. You know, I think everybody cares about the region that they live in, but we've had the luck, the wherewithal to have not just the concern and the notion and the sensitivity, but also the people that are dedicated to putting the structures in place to protect that. So
it's really wonderful.
Another reason to love the Miami Valley.
Honestly, it's so great. One of the biggest projects I'm working on right now is a comprehensive easement for Glen Helen, which means that permanently, if you choose to put this on your land, you have the land trust as a sort of silent partner, mostly silent, making sure that those conservation conditions that you want to protect are protected over time. And it actually can be purchased or can be donated, this easement. The easement document is recorded at the county courthouse just like any deed would be. and it travels with the land. Hmm. So you can sell your land. You can do a big variety of things with your land. Most people who have an easement on their property live on it. They can farm it in a variety of ways. There may be some areas where it's not a good idea to farm because it's too environmentally sensitive. You've got a wetland area. And in that case, those areas are preserved basically as they are. And as they are as good habitat for different sorts of aquatic life.
Again, it's the Tecumseh Land Trust's annual, it's not just a silent, but also a live auction a week from Friday, that's September 21st in Springfield. Tell us about some of the exciting possible winnings that you could bring with you.
Mike Brown's going to be back again. He is a for real auctioneer down from Jamestown and just a hoot. I'm hoping his wife Nova can come up with him this year because she's just as much fun as he is, and he's got his spotters, and I mean, it's funny. I think the city people might be a little intimidated at first if they haven't been to land auctions or something, but
sure.
but it's we won't make any mistakes with pulling your ear or anything. We got some very expensive seed corn once again, which for the farmers is a big old deal, you know, and it's kind of nice because they're going to be planting again next year anyhow,
right.
And the money's going to go to the land trust.
Oh, nice.
We got some sweet corn. We have got an item that was such a hit last year, a combine ride. One of the winners last year, it actually ended up selling twice, which wasn't the plan to begin with. But
the
runner-up wanted it so bad, the farmer generously said, sure.
Nice.
But he said it was like a yacht. The guy that got this ride is a boater. And he said it was like a yacht through an ocean of corn. And, oh, geez, that was a wonderful thing. There's a lot of things that bring people together that are probably my favorite items. We are going to have a Wins owner's dinner once again.
Is that would they come to your home or
Mary
you'll
Kay
go
and
to
Kemp.
The Wins?
Well, this is going to be at Whitehall, at the Whitehall Mansion.
So nice.
I got another dinner this year I am really excited about. My neighbors, Michael and Anita Brown, are going to do a dinner right there on Xenia Avenue in Yellow Springs. He is trained as a chef and is now a wine salesman.
Perfect combination.
Absolutely expert. And their home is so beautiful. They just keep doing things in the garden. And I don't know if she's a decorator or they just have got this incredible sense about food and design and everything. That's very exciting.
So some nice sort of focuses on food as far as some of the items that will be available. And again, all these proceeds benefit the Tecumseh Land Trust. And there's more information right now and always at TecumsehLandTrust.org. But not just the items for bidding, but the catering, the food that you'll be having for the patrons to enjoy.
Yeah, we get Current Cuisine is helping us again, and they keep coming up with a little something different. We've also got some of our local food vendors from our Springfield Farmers Market that are going to offer tastings.
Nice.
And we're really excited about that. That's one of the opportunities we have with the Land Trust to give people exposure to local farm visits. Local food, just a little something different. The tours that we have at the auction are the best thing because the people and the knowledge that they have is just so exciting. And that's what makes our events unique, period, I think.
There's, I see a quilt, a gorgeous handmade quilt, colonial dinner for six, vacation week at South Carolina Beach House, football tickets, four tickets to OSU versus Nebraska, eight bags of Pioneer corn, donor Pioneer hybrid. Check it out. Invasive species removal. What a nice variety, a nice cross-section. And people come forward and donate these things because they believe in this great mission.
It's amazing. We just keep making friends, and I just love that. What we do, of course, we're a private nonprofit. Two-thirds of our income is from memberships and these fundraising events.
And this is a big one for you. So if you
it's not just
is this a great event, but it's also a great event with the notion that every dollar that you spend there, your admission price, the whole ball of wax, all benefits sort of all of us in a general way, and even more so, we're looking down the road for our grandkids and so forth. far beyond. So it's one of those all wins. It's wall-to-wall win, Krista.
Hey, check out our sponsors online. It is wonderful. I mean, we have got a couple great seed and input companies that the farmers work with. We've got Pentaflex located in Springfield. We've got Orion Organics. I mean, the variety of people that come together so that it does make the auction goers' money go all towards conservation. It's just a fabulous effort.
If you'd like to find out more, and I highly recommend that you do, it's TecumsehLandTrust.org. That's their main page, and there's a link there to the auction and some of the items and to your purchasing tickets as well. Again, that's TecumsehLandTrust.org. Krista McGall, it's just always a pleasure. Thanks for keeping us posted.
Absolutely. It's always a pleasure for me, too. Anytime.
We'll get up to a little fun, all right?
All right.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Emily McCord. Ohio's voter election laws have been at the center of controversy, and here to talk to me today is Ellis Jacobs. He's an attorney for ABLE, the Advocates for Basic Legal Equality. It's a public interest law firm serving Western Ohio. Thanks for being here.
Sure, Emily. Thanks for having me.
You've been active, I know, in keeping the state's early voting hours intact over the weekends. Can you tell me, where do things stand right now?
Sure. There is a pending lawsuit brought by the Obama campaign to restore the 3 days immediately prior to Election Day, that weekend and the Monday before we all vote on Tuesday, and allow people to vote on those days. Now, the first judge that heard that, a federal district court judge, said, yeah, you need to restore those hours. Not having those hours is a violation of the Constitution, violation of the Equal Protection Clause. The Secretary of State has appealed that decision to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, and it's going to be heard before the end of this month. And so presumably before we start voting on October 2nd, we'll have an answer to that question of whether or not people will be able to go to their Board of Elections and vote in person early those last 3 days before Election Day.
Ohio has more opportunities than a lot of our neighboring states to vote. Why is it so important to restore this early voting hours? Why is it something that that you've been fighting for?
Yeah, I think that to give you a good answer to that, you have to sort of look at the big picture and a little bit of history about Ohio. In 2004, we had a pretty bad election day, if people remember that. There were long lines. People stood in lines for hours, and many people didn't actually get to vote in 2004. So many people showed up to vote that our election system couldn't handle them. And so immediately after that, the legislature passed new laws to expand the opportunities to vote in the state. And so we came up with 35 days of early voting before Election Day. And then most boards of elections added weekend hours and evening hours. And then based on that scenario, we went into 2008, and even more people voted in the state of Ohio than had voted in 2004. But everything went really smoothly. People didn't stand in lines. Nobody was turned away. And so having had this really excellent experience in 2008, I get nervous. Many people get very nervous when you see some politicians wanting to cut back on all those early voting opportunities that made it work so well in 2008. And that's why we're anxious about it.
Well, now, Secretary of State John Husted has said, I'm just trying to create uniformity between all the county boards of elections. I mean, isn't that a fair thing for him to want to do?
Well, it would make sense if all the counties were uniform, but our counties are dramatically diverse. We have rural counties where less than 10,000 people vote. We have urban counties where more than 500,000 people vote. Each of these counties by law is entitled to have one early voting center, so one location where you can go early to vote. So if I'm in a county where there are only 10,000 people that might want to vote at that one location, I'm going to be able to walk right in whenever I want and vote. If I'm in an urban county where there are 500,000 people who might want to vote early at that one location, it's pretty obvious that the urban county is going to need more hours to accommodate the people. And that's the reason why this idea of one size fits all doesn't make sense when the entities you're trying to fit are vastly different in size and capabilities.
So let's talk about some of the nuts and bolts of the election here. If you're an Ohioan, you may have just received something in the mail from the Secretary of State. What is that?
That's an application to vote an absentee ballot by the mail. And if you're absolutely sure you want to mail your ballot back in, then you should go ahead and send that application in. What will happen is you'll send the application in. The Board of Elections, when the ballots are printed at the beginning of October, will send you a ballot, and then you need to fill that ballot out and either mail it in or deliver it. But if you fail to return that ballot, when you show up on election day to vote, they'll make you vote a provisional ballot. So only send that application for an absentee ballot to vote by mail in if you're sure you want to vote by mail.
If you get one of those, does that definitely mean you're registered to vote?
Yeah, it does. They're drawing those out of the pool of registered voters. Everybody who's registered to vote right now has gotten one of those or will get one of those in a few days. If you just registered very recently, you'll get yours in a couple of weeks. If you've been registered for a while or think you've been registered for a while and you didn't get one of these applications for an absentee ballot, then you need to be wondering about whether, in fact, you're still registered to vote, and you probably should either call your local Board of Elections, go to your local Board of Elections website and check your registration, or go to the Secretary of State website and check your registration there. There might be a problem. You should check on it now, because if you check on it now, you'll have time to resolve whatever problem there might be before the cutoff for registration, which is October 9th.
Lots of information. Thank you so much. I've been speaking with Ellis Jacobs. He's an attorney for Advocates for Basic Legal Equality. Thanks for being here.
Sure, Emily. Thanks for having me.
That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook,